Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, everyone? Last time I mentioned the study group I'm hosting around IBM's AI Enterprise Workflow courses and the webinar I'll be doing this Saturday with Ray Lopez, the course's instructor. It's been awesome to see the strong community response to this new program. These courses complement the modeling-focused courses you may have taken and drill in on the end-to-end process of building, deploying, and managing real-world enterprise AI and machine learning projects. Unique to this program is the full immersion experience it offers. Consider this. You've just been hired as a data scientist working for a streaming media company. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to apply the tools of data science and machine learning to drive engagement and growth at the company. The examples, business problems, data sets, and tools you'll work with throughout the course are all woven around this scenario. The webinar will be this Saturday, February 15th at 9:30 a.m. Pacific Time. To register or learn more, visit twimlai.com/AI workflow. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Abuba Berhani. Abuba is a PhD student at University College Dublin. Abuba, welcome to the TWIML AI podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
I'm really excited about this conversation. We had an opportunity to meet in person after a long while interacting on Twitter at the most recent NeurIPS conference, in particular the Black in AI workshop, where you not only presented your paper Algorithmic Injustices Toward Relational Ethics, but you won Best Paper there. And so I'm looking forward to digging into that and some other topics. But before we do that, I would love to hear you kind of share a little bit about your background. And I will mention for folks that are hearing the sirens in the background, while I mentioned that you are from University College Dublin, you happen to be in New York now at the AIES conference in association with AAAI. And as folks might know, it's hard to avoid sirens and construction in New York City. So just consider that background or mood ambiance background sounds.
Thank you.
Your background.
yes.
How did you get started working in AI ethics?
So my background is in cognitive science, and particularly a part of cognitive science called embodied cognitive science, which has roots, you know, in cybernetics, in systems thinking. The idea is to focus on the social, on the cultural, on the historical, and kind of to view cognition in continuity with the world, with historical backgrounds and all that, as opposed to, you know, your traditional approach to cognition, which just treats cognition as something located in the brain or something formalizable, something that can be computed. So that's my background. Even during my master's, I lean towards, you know, the AI side of cognitive science. The more I delve into it, the more I much more attracted to the ethics side, to you know, injustices, to the social issues. And so the more the PhD goes on, the more I find myself in the ethics side.
Was there a particular point that you realized that you were really excited about the ethics part in particular, or did it just evolve for you?
I think it just evolved. So when I started out, at the end of my master's and at the start of the PhD, my idea is that, you know, we have this relatively new school way of thinking, which is embodied cogsci, which I quite like very much because it emphasizes, you know, ambiguities and messiness and contingencies, as opposed to, you know, drawing clean boundaries. And So the idea is, yes, I like the idea of redefining cognition as something relational, something inherently social, and something that is continually impacted and influenced by other people and the technologies we use. So the technology aspect, the technology end was my interest. So initially the idea is, yes, technology is constitutes aspect of our cognition. You have the famous 1998 thesis by Andy Clark and David Chalmers, The Extended Mind, where they claimed, you know, the iPhone is an extension of your mind. So you can think of it that way. And I was kind of advancing the same line of thought. But the more I delved into it, the more I saw, yes, digital technology, whether it's you know, ubiquitous computing such as face recognition systems on the street or your phone, whatever, yes, it does impact and it does continually shape and reshape our cognition and what it means to exist in the world. But what became more and more clear to me is that not everybody is impacted equally. The more privileged you are, the more in control of you are as to, you know, what can influence you and what you can avoid. So that's where I become more and more involved with the ethics of computation and its impact on cognition.
The notion of privilege is something that flows throughout the work that you presented at Black in AI, the Algorithmic Injustices paper, and this idea, this construct of relational ethics. What is relational ethics and what are you getting at with it?
Yeah, so relational ethics is actually not a new thing. A lot of people have theorized about it and have written about it. But the way I'm approaching it, the way I'm using it is, it kind of springs from this frustration that for many folk who talk about AI ethics or fairness or justice, most of it comes down to, you know, constructing this neat formulation of fairness or mathematical calculation of who should be included and who should be excluded, what kind of data do we need, that sort of stuff. So for me, relational ethics is kind of, let's leave that for a little bit and let's zoom out and see the bigger picture. And instead of using technology to solve the problems that emerge from technology itself, so which means centering technology, let's instead center the people that are people, especially people that are disproportionately impacted by, you know, the limitations or the problems that arise with the development and implementation of technology. So there is a robust research in, you can call it AI fairness or algorithmic injustice. And the pattern is that the more you are at the bottom of the intersectional level, that means the further away from you are from, you know, your stereotypical white cisgendered male, the bigger the negative impacts are on you, whether it's classification or categorization or whether it's being scaled and scored for by hiring algorithms or looking for housing or anything like that. The more you move away from that stereotypical category, you know, the status quo, the more the heavy the impact is on you. So the idea of relational ethics is kind of to think from that perspective, to take that as a starting point. So these are the groups or these are the individuals that are much more likely to be impacted. So in order to put them at advantage or in order to protect their welfare, what do we need to do? So that it's the idea is to start from there and then ask further questions instead of, you know, saying here we have this technology or we have this set of algorithms or calculations. How do we apply them or how do we then use them to you know, for a better or a fairer outcome?
And sometimes the answer you arrive at is that a particular technology shouldn't exist in a given form.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. So I think one of the downsides of obsessively working on some matrices or some equations on fairness is that you forget to ask in the first place, should we even do this in the first place? And I think some people have articulated this really well. You can think of this in terms of the face recognition systems that are becoming very normalized and common, especially in the States. Do you feed your face recognition algorithm with diverse data in order so that it recognizes everybody equally? Or do you stop and think, do we actually need face recognition systems in the first place? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a question that, you know, honestly, I have trouble with in a lot of ways, because I think there are certainly problematic uses of facial recognition, but often the question is posed or the assertion is made that, you know, we shouldn't use the technology or we should, you know, I guess, you know, it's not uncommon to hear people kind of take this position of, hey, we can't put the genie back in the bottle. And, you know, I think on some levels, I get that, you know, maybe that's a cop out, but in other ways, it's like pragmatic. How do you balance the idealism that I think is probably core to the approach you're trying to take with pragmatism that recognizes what is already happening and the way technology tends to develop and evolve?
I guess my approach, at least in the paper I presented at NeurIPS, is that if your starting point really is the welfare of, you know, the most disadvantaged, then I don't know how that cashes out with pragmatism or even with the whole idea of fairness, because for most approaches to fairness, whether it's explicitly laid out or whether it's implicitly implied, the idea is, it's very utilitarian, in a sense. You have you aspire to arrive at, you know, the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. So, which really doesn't work if you are from a disadvantaged group or if you are a minority, because you are not a majority in the first place. So any solutions that aspire to please the majority will always have negative consequences, and it just doesn't work. So that's the struggle with when you want to prioritize the needs and the welfare of the least privileged, and on the other hand, some form of pragmatism or what's best for the majority or, you know, the greater, the whole society. That's a tension that will always exist probably.
And so that's at the heart of this idea of relational, in a sense. It's, you know, pragmatic relative to who.
Exactly. But also, you have other face recognition might still be ripe, still open to so much controversy. But you have other examples, such as, you know, Facebook recently got a patent for socioeconomic group classification of their users. They haven't said much about where they are going to apply it or how they are going to use it. But, you know, tools like that, you can see it's insidious and anything, it's very, very unlikely anything positive or anything good will come out of it, especially for users, for people whose socioeconomic status is, from a really poor background. So the idea of, I guess, relational ethics, as well as questioning, do we need these tools in the first place? It's also thinking about, the bigger picture of what automation, whether it's job applications or whether it's housing or whether it's insurance, it's what it is it's doing to society, and what kind of values are we prioritizing and embracing in the process. So it's kind of thinking of ethics more as a habit, as kind of constantly thinking of what kind of society we want to live in, as opposed to thinking of, I have this piece of tool or this piece of equipment, and how do I make it fair, or how do I twitch with it or work it to find that balance.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of fairness is thinking about data bias and accommodating for data bias. Setting aside the issue of whether the thing that you're trying to address, is something that should be done at all, that the issue of data bias is kind of just one small piece of the overall fairness puzzle. How do you think broadly about kind of the different aspects of AI fairness and AI ethics? Do you have a categorization or framework or, way of thinking about it that you found helpful?
Yeah, so this is actually at the heart of the whole relational ethics, trying to reframe the whole idea of what ethics is. So, because as you said, a lot of people working on AI ethics really are about, whether it's explainability or calculating fairness or justice, it really is usually lost in the fine-grained details. So it's not something implementable that I provide, but it's about kind of really zooming out and thinking, what are we doing? What are we prioritizing? How are we defining bias? How are we defining ethics? How are we approaching these concepts in general? And one of the aspects that as part of the paper that I emphasized is, it's the inherent nature of machine learning, which is that we are continually predicting whether it's health issues, whether it's socioeconomic issues, whether it's who is going to be, the best employee. It's all about making predictions based on whatever data we get our hands on. So the idea of relational thinking is kind of rethinking the whole idea of predicting as something we need to pause, to stop and pause and think. Instead of continually predicting, how about we kind of take it easy and first analyze and think about the patterns that we are getting, trying to understand the reality and things as they are, as opposed to using whatever data we have as evidence for our prediction or as input into our predicting tool. So one of the examples I give is Cathy O'Neill in Weapons of Mass Destruction also mentions this, is if you take algorithms used in policing in the legal system, instead of, say, recidivism algorithms, instead of striving to predict who is likely to reoffend or who is likely to commit crime or what area should be policed more, we use our tools or we develop our tools in a way that lend themselves for us to understand why are this group of this demographic or this group of people coming up as higher risks. What can we do? How do we rehabilitate, say, prisoners instead of how do we catch them when they reoffend? So it's really switching mentality. It's thinking about how do we make the society or the world a better place? How do we help people get back on their foot rather than how do we, you know, rather than playing a gacha, rather than how do we catch them again? But so thinking of kind of prioritizing understanding, you know, questioning why do we find these patterns that we are finding and how do we improve that, really kind of aligns with this relational thinking I've been talking about, as opposed to, you know, creating and building these predictive tools.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that there's multiple levels to this idea of prioritizing understanding. There's, you know, as, you know, individuals working in these areas, we should prioritize our understanding of the people involved and the scenarios that we're involved in and how the people are interacting and affected in these various scenarios. But also, you're also suggesting that we should prioritize, you know, the tools that we build to enhance our understanding as opposed to, you know, just spitting out more and more predictions.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't yet seen many tools that aim to understand. So much of what I come across is always predictive tools. And I think prioritizing understanding really will contribute to, you know, the larger, greatness of society. Again, this is not something you can formulate or you can come up with a set of steps that you can implement. It's it's more of kind of changing your habits, developing a different set of habits. It's something you continually keep in the back of your mind, whether you are an ethicist or an engineer or a data scientist. So it really is zooming out and looking at the larger picture. But also it's not to oppose that we should throw out all implementable tools we have on whether it's fairness or accountability or explainability. It's just that we have to also look at the larger picture. And I guess another aspect of relational ethics is you might have these implementable tools. You might have this set of tools to make your system better. But the idea is, if you think of these concepts such as fairness or ethics or even your own set of solutions as something that are continually changing. So this is this goes back to at the start I was talking about how the idea of embodied cognitive science at its core comes from systems thinking and cybernetics and the social sciences. And at the heart of it is that not only can you define cognition in isolation from others or in isolation from the tools you use or in isolation from the environment, it's also that whatever your definition of cognition or whatever your understanding of the person has to account for the nature of reality, which is that it's never stable, it's never fixable, it's constantly changing. So, and it's very contextual. So you are a certain type of personality at the moment with certain expected norms talking to me on here, but some other time in some different context in some different environments you are also slightly different person. So the underlying idea is whatever concepts we are dealing with, whatever solutions we have, they cannot claim to finalize things, they cannot stabilize this continually moving nature of being. And whatever is ethical in this context might not be ethical in other contexts. So I think relational ethics helps you leave whatever solution you have somewhat partially open so that you can reiterate, so you can revise and change with whatever new evidence or new data comes up your way the next day or the next year. So this treating of things as moving and changing really is fundamental. It helps us realize our solution now is only for now within a limited context, within a limited environment. And I think that's a really important thing we can all pay attention to.
The example you gave of who is Sam in these different contexts makes me think a little bit about, in linguistics, the idea of code switching. I may speak in a particular way when I'm on the podcast, and then when I'm at home, I may speak in a slightly different way. And when I'm out, you know, in the neighborhood, I might speak in a slightly different way. And I haven't seen much in, you know, machine learning or NLP that tries to capture that or take account of that. Do you have some examples of how you might envision machine learning systems, you know, if they were to follow this aspect of relational?
Yeah. So this is really difficult. And I guess at the heart of a lot of issues. And so when you can assume things are stable and somewhat, you know, you can grasp them with whatever tools or language you have, it's much easier to construct theories or to construct some sort of tool, which is what...
Well, I mean, the stability, translates to the, you know, everything's coming from an identical distribution, which is at the foundation of most of what we do in machine learning.
Yeah. Again, I'm not really a computer scientist. As I said at the beginning, I'm a cognitive scientist, and I think mm-hmm. about cognition in persons. And I don't know any NLP tools or machine learning approaches that account for this continual change and contexts. But also, even within the cognitive science movement, especially embodied cognitive science, which is trying to push the importance of these changes, language and context, is one of the things it struggles with is because it's difficult to formalize and make up provide something conclusive, but when you are underlying change, it ends up dealing with a lot of theorizing as opposed to producing something you can model or something you can formalize. So I guess it's an existing tension. Again, it's much better to think of it as a habit and to acknowledge this continual changing nature of things, in a sense that acknowledgement makes you aware that your tool or your solution or your theory is only as good as its specification and the contexts, and that acknowledgement further encourages you to leave, not to conclude your solution or your tool as something finalizable, something that will be good all the times for all contexts, but something that you have to leave a little open, partially open, something that needs revision continually. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, for me, for me at the moment, the best one can do is acknowledge this change in context and leave this partial openness and embrace reiteration and revision.
One of the other ideas in the paper is that, or at least I interpret it as that along the lines of the idea of prioritizing understanding over prediction, one of the ideas in the paper is that, you know, when we predict, it's often based on these very reductive labels that we're applying to things. The examples you gave are, you know, successful versus not, criminal versus not. And you kind of point out that that is inherently problematic in many cases.
Exactly. You can also look at a lot of algorithms within trying to categorize or identify gender identities. And I think that's one of the most obvious cases where the harm of doing so, the harm of categorization becomes very starkly clear. Because usually, stereotypically, and in most societies, you would categorize genders either as male or female. Sometimes you might have bisexuals, but as we know, gender identities are much more than just those categories. And not only they are larger in number, those categories, but we all know that they are fluid. Someone that was bisexual or trans, take a trans person, for example, people change their sexual and gender identities. How do you then, it becomes easy to see how difficult it is for whatever algorithmic tools we are developing to account for that change. But also, as we develop that tool and kind of come up with these categories, in a sense, we are disadvantaging and excluding anybody that doesn't belong in those categories that we have created. This is where, again, the most vulnerable are, impacted the most. Yeah, so it's problematic in that regard.
I'm curious what kind of reaction you've seen to the paper.
So at NeurIPS, it was overwhelmingly positive. It was my first time in NeurIPS, and I went in thinking, oh, this is, a machine learning AI conference. I'm just, the outlier cognitive scientist slash ethicist. So I went in feeling, oh, I'm not going to fit very well. But it was really, really positive. And when the announcement that my paper had won the base paper came, I just could not believe it. As a grad student, you go to conferences, you present a poster or whatever, and some part of you sometimes, deep down, you think, oh, I might win, I might have a chance for a best poster or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I went into NeurIPS like, there is no chance. I'm just going to relax, enjoy the dinner. It was a dinner party, and I was really shocked. And so it's been really positive. I have presented similar ideas previously to very exclusively kind of very software engineer, machine learning, deep learning researchers, and people really are not interested in my ideas because people want something implementable, something they can code into, something formal, something they can use. So what I'm asking is a reframing, a rethinking, and a changing of habits. And it's almost like an activism. It's like asking, what kind of society do you want to live in? So for some people, that's really difficult and something they would rather not get involved in. But the more I interact with people, and also on Twitter, it's really, really encouraging. People seem to like what I have to say, so I'm happy.
Really quickly before we wind down, you are in New York to present a more recent paper. I believe it's more recent paper that you have worked on robot rights. Can you talk a little bit about that paper?
Yes, it's unfortunate that the title has robot rights, because it really is not about robot rights. it's robot rights, question mark. Let's talk about human welfare instead. So this paper, I worked on it with my colleague, Yeli van Dijk, from University of Twente. He also comes from a distributed cognition, embodied cognitive science background. And we talk about this a lot on Twitter, and we are constantly getting caught up in these Twitter debates, whether, machines can be sentient, or whether robots should be given rights, blah, blah, it goes on. And it's the same kind of pattern of interactions over and over and over again. And I think about four or five months ago, I asked him on Twitter, how about we write a paper on this? And writing the paper came really, really easy, because we have the same background, we think alike. So the idea of the paper is, it has, in a sense, it's twofold. The first one is kind of philosophical. So we lay out how robots are not the type of beings that can either be granted or denied rights. We lean on a lot of, embodied cogsci, as I was saying earlier. This notion of cognition as inherently social, inherently relational, people inherently, value-laden, constantly striving to make meaning of the world. So we use that post-Cartesian approach to get at the heart of how, philosophically speaking, robots or any machine learning tools or any machines at all are not the same beings as humans or even animals. And then the second part, we get at the urgent questions that AI ethics really need to focus, because most times it's really frustrating to hear robot ethics classified as part of AI ethics. And for me personally, it comes across as worrying about future, may happen, may not happen, may become sentient. A lot of it is really contemplation and thinking ahead about the future. And it all that contemplation and philosophical musing taking so much of the AI ethics space is just unfair. So a lot of the second part of our paper deals with how the very idea of AI itself, whether it's, computer vision, whether it's autonomous systems, it's never autonomous. There is always humans in the loop. And not only that, it's not possible without the exploitative human labor, whether it's tagging raw data for that's going to be part of an autonomous system, or some sort of image recognition. Even when you do recaptchas, you are in a sense you are putting in your own unpaid labor into making machines better. So that the argument we make there is that AI systems are never autonomous, and they never will be. But in the argument of whether they are autonomous or not, we lose sight of the people who are underpaid, such as the Mechanical Turk or micro workers. They never enter into the debate. We also touch upon how robot systems such as Roomba or whatever are invading private spaces as they roam around our houses, and how that should be more urgent and crucial as opposed to some stereotypical humanoid such as Sophia. And we get a little bit on algorithmic injustice as well, how the least privileged, the most disfranchised are the most impacted, and how that should be the focus of AI ethics as opposed to hypothetical sentient beings. So that's the core of the paper. And yeah.
And there's been quite a bit of discussion about this one on Twitter. In fact, we're not going to be able to get into it very deeply, but I would encourage folks to take their reactions to Twitter. Is it fair to say that this one has been more controversial than the previous one?
It appears to be so. And to be honest, when we wrote it as, when we have those never-ending conversations about rights again on Twitter, instead of repeating the conversation, we'll just have a paper to point to. But it has provoked a lot of very strong reaction from people, both defending rights for robots and both thinking it's really idiotic to even discuss rights for robots. Mm-hmm. So apparently it's controversial.
Interesting. People love their robots, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Abuba, it has been so great to have a chance to chat with you in more detail about what you're up to. Thanks so much for taking the time to share with us.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Thank you.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information about today's guest, visit twimmelai.com/shows. To learn more about the AI Enterprise Workflow Study Group I'll be leading, visit twimmelai.com/AI workflow. Of course, if you like what you hear on this podcast, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.